Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Live Through Jesus podcast with Courtney Gilmore. On this episode, we're going to be talking about God's supremacy. This is 1 Samuel 5, 6, and 7. When you play games with your really little kids, do you let them win or do you, just go full force with it? I was thinking about a story that happened with my son when he was in like kindergarten, first grade, and he was playing tetherball with the senior that was their aide at their PE class. And he said that this boy, obviously in tetherball, you really can't go full force. If an adult hits the tetherball one time over, it'll go over the head of a kindergartner, first grader, and, that's it. The game's over. And so this kid would play tetherball with my son every day at break. And I was talking to my son about it the other day, and the thing that I was remembering was how my dad taught this boy in youth. And he came to youth one day, and he told my dad, he was like, I'm about to have to beat your son in tetherball, your grandson in tetherball. And he's like, what are you talking about? And he was like, he's going and telling all his friends that he can beat me. He's like, he's getting too big of a head, and it was getting on his nerves for whatever reason. And I was telling my son that story, and he said, yeah, he said, I remember one day, he said, I truly thought as a child, I really thought to myself, I'm stronger than him. Like, I can hit harder than him. He can't even hit as hard as me. And look how old he is. I must be really good. And he said, one day this boy just hit the tetherball really hard. And he said, now, obviously, I know what he was doing. He was basically trying to show me, like, I can hit it hard. I just don't, And unfortunately for this boy, he hit it really hard and hit my son right in the face. And he said, of course, even the teachers were like, what were you doing? And he was like, well, I didn't mean to hurt him, And my son is telling me this story, and he's like, he didn't mean to hurt me, but he was trying to show me, I do actually have the power to do this. I just choose not to, And I tell you this story because that is what we're going to talk about God today. When God let the Philistines win in our lesson last week, he still had the power to win. It's just like that parent. It's just like that parent that is holding back their power so that you can win. And God did that with the Philistines, and he did that for a purpose for the Israelites. But then, just like, this senior boy that could not actually let my son think forever that he didn't have, that he couldn't hit it as hard as my son could, he had to show his power. That's what God does this week in the lesson to the Philistines. He let them win last week because he needed to teach the Israelites a lesson, but he could not let the Philistines think that they actually had more power, especially their God had more power than he did. And so he shows his power in this lesson. And so this is a really fun lesson. This is something to just see how God actually, is really like us. It's the same, thought process. And so I'm going to go ahead and just begin reading in 1 Samuel 5, and then we'll just kind of stop as we're going through and talk about this. And then at the end, we'll talk about what this means for us, how we can look at God differently and, know these things about him ourselves. And so this is 1 Samuel 5:1, and it says, when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Now, Ashdod is like all the way to the west. And so, they're fighting on the eastern side of their border. And then once they capture the ark, they're like, we're taking this as far away from Israel as we can. And so this is like 3 miles inland from the Mediterranean Sea, pretty much, almost as far west as they could get it. And it says, then the Philistines took the ark of God and they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. Dagon was their god, the Philistine god. And so what they were doing is basically saying, apparently our god is more powerful than your god because we just captured, the ark of your god. And now we're going to sit it in our temple. You no longer have it. It's going to be in our temple and, you know, with our God, who is apparently more powerful than you. But this is how God shows them that that's not true. In verse 3, it says, when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of God. And so, like, he's bowing down to God, right? God has made their idol fall down in front of him as if he's bowing towards them, towards him. But they don't catch this. And so it says they took Dagon and put him back up in his place, like, oh, weird, but whatever. And then in verse 4, it says, when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both of his hands were lying cut off on the threshold, and only the trunk of Dagon was left on him. And so this time he falls face down in front of God, bowing to God. But that's only his torso, because his head and his arms have broken off and they're laying on the threshold of God. And this is all a bit of symbolism trying to show them, if his head is cut off, then he has no mind and he has no mouth, right? And so he's trying to say to them, your God has no ability to think or speak. And then his arms are gone, saying, and your God has no ability to work for you. And so what God is trying to show them is, your God is feckless and impotent. He has no ability to think or speak or act on your behalf. He's actually incapable of doing anything. So not only am I more powerful than your God, but your God has no power at all. He's just an inanimate object. And so after all of this, it says in verse 5, this is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. And that's referring to because the head and arms have fallen on the threshold, and providing that their sacred, God had fallen on the threshold, they didn't feel that they were worthy to even touch the threshold as they walked into the temple. And so they would always step over it as a show of reverence to their God, because their God had touched that place. And the commentaries that I read, which is very interesting, said that they have evidence that the people in Gaza were doing this into the first centuries AD. They were still stepping over the threshold. And I don't know what that evidence is, but several commentaries said that this tradition, you know, carried on over 1,000 years into the first centuries AD there in that area. And so then, beginning in verse 6, no, yes, 6, it says, the hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And so God was afflicting them with, this version says tumors. I think some versions say boils. The actual Hebrew word that they use here, it just means for swellings. And so they had swellings of some sort all over their body, some sort of growth. And later on, we hear them talking about an infestation of mice. And so many scholars believe that God hit them with the bubonic plague, because the bubonic plague would cause the lymph nodes to swell up and look like, you know, tumors or boils or something of that nature. But it's just all of the bacteria or virus or whatever it is inside of those lymph nodes. And so it also carried with it, fever and things like that. But an infestation of mice would be able to spread the bubonic plague. And it was very contagious and it was deadly without modern medicine. And so many people think that that's what God had sent the bubonic plague onto these people that live there in Ashdod. And so it says in verse 7, when the men of Ashdod saw how these things were, they said, the ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God. So they're recognizing that all of this is happening to them because of Israel's God. God made their God fall down before him and break apart. And God also is the one that's causing this plague against them right now. And they want to get rid of the ark. Just, we're done with this being anywhere around us. And so in verse 8, it says, so they sent and gathered together all of the lords of the Philistines and said, what should we do with the ark of the Lord of God of Israel? And they answered, let the ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And this was like 12 miles to the east. And so they brought the ark of God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against that city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of that city, both young and old, so that the tumors broke out on them. And so they sent the ark of God to Ekron, which is the closest large city to Israel. So they keep moving it, you know, further and further away from the coast where they had it in the first place and closer to Israel. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people cried out, they have brought around to us the ark of God of Israel to kill us and our people. And for there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were struck with tumors. And the cry of the city went up to heaven. And so at first when I read deathly panic went through the city, I just thought, you know, they're just terrified. But no, they actually meant people died of fright, because it says all those that didn't die of this deathly panic died of this plague that God was sending upon them. And so then we begin in chapter 6, verse 1, and it says, the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. So they had been bouncing it around for 7 months and were, you know, sick of it now. And so in verse 2, the Philistines called out for the priests and the diviners and said, what should we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place. So it's basically like saying, we want to send it back to Israel. What should we send with it? And so the diviners and the priests said in verse 3, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty. By all means, return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand has not turned away from you. And so basically they're saying, you know, you took this ark from them. You can't send it back empty-handed. You have to send it back basically with an apology gift, saying, you know, I know I shouldn't have done this. Please take this gift as, you know, a token of our, you know, great repentance of what we have done. And so they asked, what gift should we give? And in verse 4, it says, what is the guilt offering that we should return? And they answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off of you, your gods, and your land. And so they're saying, when you send it back with this gift needs to say, I know that your God is punishing us because we took this. And so we're so very sorry that we took this. Please accept this gold in you know, repentance for that. And so it's showing that they know that the mice infested them with some sort of disease that's causing these swellings. And so they're giving a picture of the swellings and the mice, saying, we know that God sent these mice to give us this disease. And it says they're going to give five in accordance with the five different provinces of the Philistines, because this has touched every single province. And so we don't know if it's gone to more than the three cities that are mentioned here, and these are just the major cities, or if it's just that these cities are like on the edge of another province, and because it affected the city and their territory, that it spread and has hit at least every province in the Philistial lands. But that's what it's basically saying, you know, God has hit us with this plague that has actually, you know, ravaged our entire land. And then the priests say in verse 6, why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After God dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away and they departed? And so what they're saying is we shouldn't be stubborn like the Egyptians were, because the Egyptians got plagues sent on them, but they kept resisting. And, you know, when that happened, they thought that maybe they could resist God, but they never were able to actually resist God. And eventually they did the thing that God wanted them to do in the very beginning. And so they should have just relented after the first plague. And we've only had one plague. So let's go ahead and, you know, submit ourselves, humble ourselves before the Lord and say, we're done. They actually said, give glory to the God of Israel. Let's just do that. Because the Egyptians eventually had to do that anyway, but instead of having one plague, they had 10 plagues on them. And one of the plagues that finally made them send them away was the death of their own sons. And so it's like, let's not be hardening our heart like the people in Egypt did, and then end up doing what God wanted them to do anyway. Let's just do it in the very first place. And then in verse 7, it says, now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take the calves away from there. And then take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put in a box at its side the figures of gold, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go on its way, and watch. If it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he, God, who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us, and it just was a coincidence. And so he was saying, I want you to pick these two cows specifically that happen to be nursing their calves and also have never had a yoke on them. And the reason that I want you to pick those specific cows to haul the Ark of God back towards Israel is because any cows that have not ever had a yoke on them will not know how to run the cart well. And so they probably won't stay on the road. And also, if they're nursing their calves and you put their calves away from them and send them the opposite direction of their calves, and they go against their own instincts that would tell them to turn around and nurse their calves, and they stay on the road the whole time and make it to Israel, going against their instincts to nurse their calves, going against their instincts to turn off of the road, then we know that only God could make them turn away from their instincts like that. And so we would know that God is the one that has done this plague against us. But if they, you know, do exactly what we expect for them to do, what we would normally expect for them to do, which would be to try to turn back around and get to their calves, or to turn off of their road, not know, you know, that they're supposed to stay on the path, then we will think, okay, it was just a coincidence, and we won't have to send the ark back. And so it says in verse 10, so the men did so. They took the two milk cows, and they yoked them to the ark, and they shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on a cart, and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right or to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. And so they didn't go against their instinct. I mean, they did go against their instincts. They stayed exactly on the path, even though they had never done that before. And they did not go back to nurse their calves, although you know they wanted to, because they were crying the whole time for their calves, which is so sad. But this just goes to show us that they could not have... that God was forcing them, even though they wanted to turn around and go back and nurse their calves. They were being compelled by God to continue on the path. And so this let them know that, yes, this has been God all along. And then in verse 13, it says the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, which would have been around the time of June. And when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. And a great stone was there. And so they split up the wood of the ark, and they offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, and in which were the golden figures, and they set them upon a great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. Now, they weren't normally supposed to make an altar and offer sacrifices, not in the tabernacle. But remember that the ark of God is no longer there, and all of the priests are dead. Eli and both of his sons are dead. Samuel is the only one that's left, but since the ark of God wasn't there, they had ceased to make sacrifices at the temple. Basically, the temple was not a working temple at this time. And so they may as well offer a sacrifice out in the field when all of this has happened. And the ark of God is there. And so that means they are making the sacrifices in the presence of God, which is what they would have been doing if the ark was in the tabernacle as it was supposed to be. Also, Beth Shemesh is a Levitical city, and we see that it says the Levites took down the ark of the Lord. And so the Levites would have been the people that would have been able to offer sacrifices anyway. And so they have people there that are qualified to officiate the sacrifices, and they have the ark of God there. And so they make the sacrifices there in the field of Joshua. And then in verse 16, it says, when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned that day to Ekron. So when they saw that, you know, it had made it where it was supposed to go, they knew that this was all God. And so they left. And these are the golden tumors they returned as a guilt offering to the Lord: Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages. And so they're just saying, you know, again, that they had made five of them to represent the five major cities, major provinces that, you know, had to do with where the ark had been and the plague and everything. And then right after that, they say, the great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness this day in the field of Joshua in Beth Shemesh. And so they set this stone up as a memorial to remember exactly what has happened that day, how the ark had been returned to them and they had worshiped God. Now, we're going to continue on in verse 19, where it says, God struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. And so we don't know exactly what these men did with the ark that angered God. It just says that they looked upon it. They probably were glaring on it. They were staring at it. And the prepositions sometimes can be tricky, translating from Hebrew to English. And so it could have mean that they looked in the ark. You know, they were definitely treating it with irreverence. You know, maybe they've obviously never seen the ark, because the only people that were able to see the ark when it was in the tabernacle were the priests that worked there. And so they'd probably never seen it before. And, you know, used to the people saw it when they would travel, but no one's been traveling for years and it's been set up in Shiloh. And so they were probably just treating it with irreverence, you know, looking at it, looking in it, you know, touching it, all of those things, which was all forbidden. And so God struck 70 of the men dead. And then in verse 20, it says, then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? To whom shall he go up away from us? So they're like, we're afraid now too, because, you know, everybody died in the celestial land that had the ark. And now we're seeing that we're dying here because of the ark, and we really don't want it here. God is too awesome for us, and he has too much power, and we don't want it here. And so in verse 21, it says, so they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. The men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. And so what they're saying is they found this priest, this Levitical man that they could take the ark to, and it stayed there at his house. And then they anointed his son to basically take care of it. And then it says in verse 2, for the day that the ark was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. They grieved for God. They knew that they were not in the presence of God anymore, and they didn't have a temple. And God was just staying at this guy's house. And so for 20 years, they're sad about this. And so finally, after, you know, some 20 odd years, in verse 3, it says, Samuel said to all of the house of Israel, if you are returning to the Lord with all your heart, then put away the foreign gods and the Ashtoreth from among you, and direct your heart to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. And so the people of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtoreth, and they served the Lord only. And then Samuel said, gather all of Israel at Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. And so what he's saying is that you're mourning for the Lord, and you don't have to mourn for him anymore if you will just direct your hearts totally to him. Put away any other foreign gods that you have adopted from the nations that you didn't drive completely out of here, and decide to worship only God. And then I want you to gather here together, and I will pray for you that God will forgive you. And so they do this. They put their gods away, and then they gather in Mizpah. And beginning in verse 6, it says, so they gathered at Mizpah, and they drew water, and they poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted on that day, and they said, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the people of Israel at Mizpah. And so at this time, they are fasting to show that, you know, they're repentant. And pouring out the water is showing, we have water here to drink, but we're not even going to drink it. We're going to pour it out on the ground, because we are depriving ourselves, making a sacrifice on our own to you, God, saying, I'm sacrificing even my needs right now, because I want you to see that I'm willing to make a sacrifice to you, and that, you know, I want to put away all of my own needs and thoughts and wants and everything and yield to you. You are the only one I'm going to serve now. And then in still in verse 7, It says, "Now then, when the Philistines heard that the people of Israel had gathered at Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the people of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And the people said to Samuel, 'Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines.' And so Samuel took a nursing lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. And Samuel cried out to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him." Now, we don't know exactly why the Philistines attacked the Israelites while they were there in Mizpah. Maybe they thought they were an easy target because they're all gathered in one place. And so they're like, let's go and fight them now. We can probably defeat them easily. Maybe they thought that Israel was gathering against them and this was a preemptive strike against them. But whatever it was, it started to make the Israelites scared. And so they asked Samuel to pray for them. And Samuel offered a burnt offering to God and then prayed for them. And it says that God answered their prayer. And so in verse 10, it says, "As Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to attack Israel. But the Lord thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines and threw them into confusion, and they were defeated before Israel." And both of the ways that they're describing God right there is been kind of foreshadowed by a couple of different people and incidents. Where it says that God thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines, when Hannah had brought Samuel to Eli at the temple and, you know, gave him over to God there, she sang a song. And in her song, she said that the Lord God would thunder against his adversaries. And so when it says that God thundered with a mighty sound that day against the Philistines, that was kind of a foreshadowing of what she had said that God would do. And then saying that God threw the Philistines into confusion, he did this with the Egyptians too. When the Egyptians did let them go initially, but then they decided they didn't want to let them go anymore and they pursued them. And when God parted the Red Sea and the Israelites walked across on dry land, well, then when the Egyptians followed them across, it says that God threw them into confusion and made the wheels of their chariots wobble until they fell off and they were stuck there in the middle of the Red Sea. And then God let the sea collapse on them and kill all their entire army. And so it's just kind of neat how he talks about these things. And we see that God threw the Philistines into confusion, and he had also done that to the Egyptians. And then it says in verse 11, "The men of Israel went out from Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them as far as below Bethkar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin and called its name Ebenezer. For he said, 'Till now the Lord has helped us.'" So he's saying God is always helping us. And Ebenezer means the Lord helps. And so you might hear the word Ebenezer used. We have a hymn that we sing sometimes that calls God our great Ebenezer. And so he's just our great help, the one that helps us. And so in verse 13, it says, "The Philistines were subdued and did not again enter the territory of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. The cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines. And there was peace always also between Israel and the Amorites." And so what it's saying is all of the years of Samuel after this, they didn't have any problem with the Philistines or any of the people, the rest of the people that lived in the land of Israel. They had peace. So this was their last battle that they had with them at this time. And they also recovered the territory that the Philistines had taken that was there on the edge of, Israel towards the Philistine land. And it says in verse 15, "Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went on a circuit year by year to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, And he judged Israel in all of these places. And then he would return to Ramah, for his home was there. And there also he judged Israel. And he built an altar to the Lord there. So it basically just says he would go from town to town, you know, managing Israel is what they mean by judging it, you know. And then he would return to his home in Ramah. And that is where his parents lived. And so presumably after Eli died and there was no reason to stay there at the tabernacle, then Samuel moved back to where his parents had lived because he had always kept a relationship with them. They would come and visit him and he knew that they were his parents. And so now he came back to live near his parents. And so he would circulate every year, check on everybody, see if anybody needed anything, take care of them, and then return back to his home. And there he had also built an altar to God. And so that is the end of the story here. But I want to talk about what the Israelites and the Philistines thought about when God let the Philistines defeat the Israelites. And it goes back to the story that I told you in the very beginning. When God's people were defeated, it looked as if God didn't have the power to defend them, right? And it looked like the Philistines' God did have more power than Israel's God, or they wouldn't have been able to win. But God never lost his power. He was always superior to all the others. It was just like whenever we let a child win. We still have the power. We haven't lost the power. We're just restraining our power, right? But then, so he had restrained his power for the purpose of teaching the Israelites a lesson, but he could not allow the Philistines to think that they had actually more power than he did. And so just like I told you that boy just got a little irritated after a little bit and decided to show my son that he had the power to hit that ball hard and he just was not using it. That is what God did with the Philistines. He said, no, I had the power to defeat you. I just chose not to. But it had nothing to do with you. It had everything to do with my people. And I was restraining my power for them. But I'm going to reveal my power to you. I'm going to let you see that I actually had it. And so God couldn't let the Philistines think that their God was more powerful than him. And so he had actually forced their God to bow down to him. And then sent this plague on the people, forcing them to humble themselves and glorify him, humble themselves and give the ark back to the Israelites. He made everyone acknowledge his power. And so I want us to just end by thinking about ourselves, how, you know, God does sometimes look powerless to us because it looks like a defeat in our minds. We're thinking if God had the power to do this, surely he would. You know, if we are asking God for something and he does something different, it's like, why would he do it that way? It makes no sense to us. And so we think that God looks maybe defeated. But God's not defeated. He's just restraining his power. God, what looks like a defeat to us, is actually sometimes a victory to God. God's always victorious. And so we may think it's a defeat, but it's actually not. God knows that this is actually a victory. And, you know, his loss in this story was to teach the Israelites a lesson. But once they learned that lesson, then they were more victorious than they ever would have been if they would have not had that ark captured and not had their priests killed, because they would have continued on in their sin because they had no consequences. And so by giving them a defeat, God was actually giving them victory by letting them see that they needed to rely on God and listen to him and follow his ways, as opposed to doing things the way that they wanted to do. And once they realized that, then they actually were victorious. And so God knows what he's doing. And when he restrains his power, it is always for a reason. And we may be tempted to think to ourselves, you know, we've been asking God for this thing that we believe is good, and then he's not doing it, or he's doing it in a different way. And so we think he must not have enough power to do this thing that we're asking, because this is a good thing. But the problem is that what we see as good, what we see as victorious, what we see as a defeat, is not always the case. What God sees as good is sometimes not the same things, because God's interested in something different. He wasn't interested in their victory in a battle. He was interested in their victory with him, in their victory with living a life that is pleasing to him, that is following him. And, you know, God is always more interested in, you know, our growth, our maturity, our spiritual, relationship with him, our relationships with people here on this earth, than he ever is anything material, or, you know, that shows worldly success and things like that. And so I'm going to end by reading you three pretty long passages, but they're the only verses that I'm going to read you today. And it just kind of shows, one, how God works, and how what looks like defeat to us is actually victory to God, and then how God cares about different things than we do. And so in Amos 4:6, it says, "I, God, gave you cleanness of teeth in all of your cities, and lack of bread in all of your places, yet you didn't return to me." And so what God is saying here is that I made you hungry so that maybe you would cry out to me, and yet you didn't. And then in verse 7, he says, "I also withheld the rain from you when there were yet 3 months to harvest. And I would send rain on one city and then send no rain on another city. One field would have rain and another field would wither. And so two or three cities would wander to another city to drink water and wouldn't be satisfied. Yet you didn't return to me. So I withheld rain." That sounds like, a defeat to us, something that is lacking. Why would you do that? But he said, "I was doing it because I wanted you to turn to me." Verse 9, "I struck you with blight and mildew. Your many gardens and your vineyards, your fig trees and your olive trees, the locusts devoured, yet you didn't return to me. I sent among you a pestilence after the manner of Egypt. I killed your young men with a sword and carried away your horses, and I made the stench of your camp go up into your nostrils, yet you didn't return to me." So he's like, "I even killed you with plagues and with battle, so that maybe you would return to me, but you did not. I overthrew some of you, as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and you were a brand plucked out of the burning, yet you didn't return to me." So he's saying, I killed a lot of you, but the ones of you that were left, I plucked out of that burning city, and yet you still didn't return to me. "Therefore, thus I will do to you, O Israel, because I will do this to you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel. For behold, he who forms the mountains and creates the wind and declares to man what is his thought, who makes the morning darkness and treads on the heights of the earth, the Lord, the God of hosts, is his name." And so he's saying, I saved you. You are the only ones left that weren't hit by this. And yet, if you don't change, then you're going to die too. And he says, if I have the power to make the mountains and create the wind and declare to you what your own thoughts should be and create the darkness and walk all over the earth, you know, if I am this person, then don't you think I have power? It's not that I didn't have power. It's that I was trying to restrain it from you so that you would return to me. And then down in chapter 5, verses 14 and 15, it says, "So seek good and not evil, that you may live. And so the Lord, the God of hosts, will be with you, as you have said. Hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate. And then it may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant." And so he's saying, I did all of these things, But I want you to turn away from your evil ways, or you're going to end up dead like everybody else. You need to seek good and hate evil. So when it looks like that God doesn't have power, he does. He just restrains it sometimes to teach us something that's way more important than even our own food, our own lives. He wants our lives with him to be right. And then I'm going to read you the entire chapter of Ecclesiastes 2. This is Solomon speaking, and Solomon is the richest man. He has everything that he needs, and it just shows you what we think sometimes that we want. The things that we think that we need, God is like, that's not what you need. I'll tell you what you need. It's me. And Solomon goes through how his like revelation of this, how he comes to this conclusion himself. And so this is Ecclesiastes 2:1, and it says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. And I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during a few days of their life. And I made great works. I built houses, and I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them in all kinds of fruit trees. I made for myself pools from which water the forest of growing trees. And I bought male and female slaves, and I had slaves who were born in my house. And I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. And I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, and delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. All my wisdom still remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And so I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there was more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. And then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For all of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in my days to come, all will have been forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. And so I hated my life, because what is done under the sun is grievous to me. All is vanity and striving after the wind. So he said, you know, at first I thought, okay, it's not these things. These aren't the things that are going to make me happy. But what's important is for me to be wise. And I realized, I mean, yeah, I guess that's good while I'm here on this earth, but I'm going to die just like the fool. And so what is the point of me even being wise? What is the point of any of this? And so he hated his life because he saw no purpose in it. And then in verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to a man who will come after me, who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all that I toiled for and used my wisdom under the sun. This is all vanity. And so I turned about and I gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labor under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not work for it. And so it's all vanity and a great evil. He's like, even the things that I work for, none of it matters, because one day I'm going to die and I can't take these things with me. And then somebody else is going to inherit this. And I don't know if they're going to be a good person or bad, and if they're going to squander this away or not. And so none of it means anything. And then in verse 22, he says, what has a man from all of the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all the days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. It's all vanity. And then here comes his realization. He says in verse 24, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his work. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from God, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases God, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he's given the busyness of gathering and collecting, only to give to the person that pleases God. It's all vanity and striving after the wind. So what he's saying is that all of these things mean nothing without God. And the person that pleases God, God gives wisdom and knowledge, but the one that doesn't please God, he is always busy trying to gather and collect. He's always trying to have these things, but none of them matter because he actually doesn't have the thing that really matters, which is God, and everything that he does have is going to eventually be given to the godly man. And so this just goes to show us that what we see as good, God doesn't always see as good. And what we see as a defeat, God sees as victory. Solomon needed to go through this so that he could see that God was the one that he really, really needed. And so I'm going to end with this passage. This is Proverbs 2, 1 to 15. And it says, my son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commands within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding, yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as a hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and you will find knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for he is upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity and every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. Discretion will watch over you. Understanding will guard you, delivering you from the way of evil, from men perverted of speech, who forsake the pathways of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perverseness of evil, men whose paths are crooked and whose ways are devious. And so I read this passage just to say that the most important thing is following God. And when God can get you to follow him, then he gives you the things that actually matter. Understanding, wisdom, insight, knowledge, righteousness, justice, equity, discretion. So God gives you all of these things. These are the things that matter to him. But you get those things because you follow him. And when you don't follow him, you are an evil man who ends up having none of these things. And these are the things that actually matter. And so whatever God has to do to get us to follow him so that we can have the things that really matter, then that's what he's going to do. He's not concerned with our temporary victories here on this earth. He's not concerned with our money and our prestige and all of the things that we think that matter here on this earth. He is like, what matters to me is your character, your growth, your relationship with people on this earth, and your relationship here with me. And if I have to make you defeated in one area that doesn't really matter in order to give you the things that do really matter, then that's what I'll do. And so we need to see that God is not powerless. He is only restraining his power for a time, for a purpose. And we need to seek to find out what that purpose is so that we can experience the peace that the Israelites finally experienced when they finally learned their lesson. They had no more wars in the time of Samuel after they learned this lesson. And we want that peace. We want that joy. We want that understanding and that wisdom and that knowledge and discretion and justice and all of those things. And we can't get that if we're seeking after earthly victories and earthly goodness. And so we need to trust that God has a purpose when he's restraining his power and seek to know what it is, learn that lesson so we can then have the things that really do matter. And so that's all I have for today. Please join us next week so we can see what happens at the end of Samuel's life with the people. And it's going to kind of usher us into the age of the kings. And so make sure you subscribe so you don't miss that episode. If you would like this lesson in written form so that you can read the verses on your own and so you can kind of really absorb it, then you can go to livethroughjesus.substack.com and you can become a paid subscriber there. It's only $6 a month or $60 a year. And then you can get all of these written lessons emailed to you each week, along with access to all of the previous lessons, which are from the Ten Commandments, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. And, you know, this is a cheap way for you to do a Bible study with a group because you can just get one subscription and then you can print out all the materials that you need. It's also digital is kind of a neat way to do a Bible study because all of the scriptures are linked. And so all you have to do is go in there and click on that link and then you can read the scripture and you can change it to whatever version you want to read in. And that just keeps you from having to turn back and forth in the Bible all the time. And so everything is kind of right there. And so if you're the type of person that likes to, you know, kind of get the material and read it yourself, or if you would like to do these studies with your group, then that would be a good option for you. But they're always free on Substack and podcast, and so you don't have to do the paid option. But another thing on Substack is you can become a free subscriber, and you'll get the blog posts that I send out each week over these lessons. And when you get those blog posts, you will see that it's not the lesson. All it is what I learned from it. And so, like this week, it'll be what I learned about, you know, how we need to see God's power and know that he's not powerless, even though he may look it at that time. And so things like that you will get from your free subscription to Substack. And then you can also listen to those devotions if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions, or the podcast channel, Live Through Jesus Weekly Devotions. That's how you can listen to those things also for free. So one thing that is paid and then multiple free options. And then you can also subscribe to my social media pages that are all at livethroughjesus.com. So that's all that I have for you today. And I hope to see you back next week. So thanks and have a good day. Thank you.